Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. I want to welcome you all to our hearing today, but I will have a special welcome on behalf of the court to Hamilton High School students. Would they please stand?
Good girl.
Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from across the state are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're given materials about the case. They may engage in some outside activities relating to the case, and they come for an oral argument. And the court assigns a justice each day to meet with the students after the second oral argument. And the students and the justice discuss the procedures of the court in accepting and deciding cases. The discussion is not about the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to attend these noon sessions. Would anyone like a summary of the case we're about to hear? If you would like a summary, just raise your hand, and the marshal will give you a summary. Okay? Hearing no one or seeing no one request a summary, I assume you will all be familiar with the facts and the legal issues. So let me introduce the court to you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, and I'm the Chief Justice. And to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And Justice Crooks is the justice assigned to meet with the group today. To the left of Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Rogensack, and to the left of Justice Rogensack is Justice Gableman. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is an empty chair because Justice Prosser will not be participating in this case. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case, which is 10AP784, State versus Tyler T. Arguing on behalf of Tyler T. is Assistant State Public Defender Susan E. Alicia. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. As the Chief Justice said, I am Susan Alicia. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender, and I represent Tyler in this case. We're here this morning on a juvenile waiver case. The juvenile code provides that under certain circumstances, a person under the age of 17 can be waived into adult court to face adult criminal charges, to face adult criminal penalties. Because the consequences of waiver into adult court can be severe, both in terms of the penalties and other consequences that would go beyond that, the juvenile code creates a careful procedure that must be followed before a child is waived into adult court. Now, that waiver procedure reflects the basic structure and the principles of the juvenile code, which provides for three distinct parts: the prosecution, the defense, and the court. The code creates clear roles for each of these parts, and the code provides the court with an additional tool to assist it in making its decisions. That tool is the county department, social workers, and its resources. The juvenile code makes the county department an agent of the court by delineating tasks to the department that are for the court, that are ordered by the court, and that are on behalf of the court. Now, after a waiver petition is filed, The juvenile court will designate an agency, in this case the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services, to submit a waiver investigation report. That report analyzes the waiver criteria in 938.18 sub 5. That report is filed with the court. It's the court that distributes the report to the parties, and the statute sets out that the court may rely on facts in that report when making its findings on the waiver criteria. So the department here is an agent of the court. It's performing a function for the court as delineated by the statute. It prepares a report because the court says, prepare a report. It gives the report to the court, and the court gives the report to the parties. Now, the problem we have in this case is that when the agent for the court held the staffing meeting to determine its recommendation on whether Tyler would be waived into adult court or whether he should be retained in the juvenile system, the prosecutor was invited to that departmental staffing meeting. Defense counsel was neither informed of the meeting nor invited.
Counselor, though, wasn't he talked to twice? Didn't the woman who chaired the meeting call him up and ask him what his position was on waiver and about the issues of waiver?
You're referring to the prosecutor or defense counsel?
The defense attorney.
The defense attorney, the record states that the defense attorney and the social worker had met in the hall and chatted about the case a few times, but not in any formal setting like a staffing meeting where a decision was going to be made. And that would have been one social worker talking to defense counsel as opposed to the group.
I thought it was the same person who wrote the report.
It is the same person who wrote the report. That's correct. That's correct.
But there were other people involved in making the recommendation.
There was a group of 10, yes.
You don't object, do you, if you do, to the ultimate decision makers about the report, about the recommendation? There are more than one. You don't object to any of them talking with either the prosecutor or the defense counsel, do you?
My objection is not talking to and exchanging information. What my objection is ex parte advocacy at this departmental meeting.
Well, isn't it more than that? This is not just a departmental meeting to talk about what everybody knows about Tyler T. If I understand this, this is a meeting of several people, and that they are going to make a recommendation about waiver, and that one person is going to write up that report that will include the recommendation. And at this meeting, which is a final meeting, and if I'm wrong about the facts, you're supposed to correct me. This is my impression. This is the final meeting among all these people, and they are going to vote on a recommendation. And at this meeting, where they're going to vote for a recommendation, is the prosecutor, and that he is not silent, just sitting by listening. He is advocating that there be waiver, which is his position in the petition. Are those the facts?
That's correct, yes.
At least those are the facts that you want us to believe.
Well, in terms of what happened at the meeting, in the state's brief, the state concedes that what happened at the meeting was the prosecutor advocated for waiver.
In a final meeting on the recommendations where they were voted, and the result was, in that meeting, no recommendation was made.
That's correct.
We don't know how they divided or why they divided, but...
That's correct. There's no record of what exactly happened at the meeting. What we do know, again, is the state conceded that it advocated for waiver.
Why isn't...
I'm done. I just
want to
get the facts straight.
No harm, no foul, which is another way of course, saying no prejudice or prejudice analysis. Facts here, as I understand it, include the judge making a record that I am deciding this independently. I'm paraphrasing. Mr. Thompson of the department saying even before the DA, assistant DA, was present, there were strong voices for waiver at the meeting, and of course strong voices for not waiver. Why can't you mix that up and say based on those facts there's no prejudice, and even if there was error, there was no prejudice?
Well, there's a couple layers to look at. First, are we looking at prejudice in terms of the agent of the court making that recommendation? And second, we look at it in terms of the judge having that report and believing that it's his agent creating this independent report. In terms of what happened at the meeting and how it affected the people at the meeting, I mean, we don't know, right? We have no record. We don't know what people were thinking. So for us to say it had no effect, we can't say that. Just as I can't stand here and say absolutely definitively it changed everyone's mind in that room and there's absolute prejudice on that basis, the state can't say it didn't make a lick of difference what I said. Nobody was affected by it. I think if we look at what happened here, we have a trained advocate. We have.
Before you get to that, you said that there's two levels. So this is the first level.
Correct.
Did it affect the meeting? What's the next level?
The court. The court reviews the report and then makes its decision on waiver. And so the question is, does the district attorney's presence at that meeting, the resultant no recommendation coming from the department, how does that impact the court? And that's the second level.
And with regard to the first level that you talk about, you say, well, we don't know if it had any effect. It's you can't unscramble the egg sort of argument. Who has the burden?
I think in this case, we're looking at a question of process, okay? And we have a situation where neither side can prove anything because we don't know. When we look to the cases, the PSI cases like Souchacki, it talks about that, the subconscious effect. And I believe it's in Souchacki where they say, we can't ask the defendant to prove that there has been this influence because it's not possible to prove. Because we could have all 10 department members come into this court and say, that didn't influence me, that didn't influence me, that didn't influence me, but we still don't know because they may not know. It may be a very sincere belief that I listened, but I wasn't influenced. But as Souchacki says, there's this subconscious influence. There's this effect on you when you hear something, and you may say, well, I discounted that, but maybe it did influence you. So I guess the answer to that question really comes back to the problem in this case, and that is when we have ex parte advocacy at a meeting like this, we can't unring the bell, and we can't go back and get inside people's minds and say how it influenced them. So rather than looking at burden, I think we just need to look at this can't happen. Because once it happens, there's no way for anyone to say definitively what went on in people's minds.
Counsel, does it make any difference whether or not the assistant DA came on his own or whether he was invited to the meeting?
To me, that makes no difference.
What was the case here?
He was invited to the meeting.
And who sent out the invitation to him or called him or whatever?
My understanding was it was the social worker who prepared the report, but I don't know that for certain. I just know that the district attorney was invited to appear at the staffing meeting.
You know, let us just assume you're right, that the assistant DA should not have been invited. He should have not been there. He should have not spoken. This was not his time. This was time for an independent analysis for the judge, and that the DA's time was with the judge, along with the public defender or defense counsel. So let's get to the second level of your argument. So I'm going to, for the moment, say, okay, let's just assume they were all influenced, subconsciously or not. The judge then gets what's bad evidence in your theory, right? Judges get a lot of, quote, bad evidence, that is, evidence that's not admissible, but it comes in. Judge sits alone. The judge says, I'll let it in for what it's worth. Then the judge makes the decision. Sometimes the judge doesn't even say whether they relied on it. But this judge says, away. I am not going to look at it. I'm going to look at everything else. I'm not going to consider it. Don't think it's good practice, but I'm not going to say it's reversible error. I'm not going to look at it. I've got enough here, and he touches all the bases. I assume he touched all the bases. They didn't do a physical count on it, did all the bases of all the criteria for waiver and says, and there's enough evidence in here, isn't there, to support him? I mean, taking that aside, the report, isn't there enough to support this judge on what he said?
Well, if you're asking, I mean, we're certainly not raising that there's a misuse of discretion.
That's right. That's right. So if that didn't happen, that report was not bad and didn't happen, there's enough in here and the judge does enough to do it. And that isn't that harmless error?
Well, oftentimes there can be enough to justify either direction. I mean, I could stand up here and say, well, there was enough in that report and there was enough at that hearing to say that retention was a proper choice. So
sure, but the judge makes that decision, and we don't second-guess it.
But we don't know, again, our position is there's a taint underlying that decision. He has a report that says we're not making any recommendation.
Your position then really has to be that there is nothing like prejudicial error here. That report is essential in this proceeding.
Correct.
The concept of that report is that it's by a fair, neutral, impartial decision maker, and that that didn't happen, and it is a structural, if you're going to use harmless error kind of thing. I hate to bring in all these other extraneous matters, which are their own problems, but the essence of it, it is structural. It cannot be repaired.
Yes. Yes, because as I talked about the effect it could have on the department in having this ex parte advocacy, it trickles down. So we have a report. Maybe if the district attorney isn't at that meeting, instead of this, what the social worker characterizes as an unusual situation where they made no recommendation, maybe there's a recommendation for retention. And then the judge has a report that says the department recommends retention in the juvenile system. How does that influence the judge? We don't know. I think it could make a difference to a judge saying, well, here the department has discussed this and talked about it and thought it through, and they believe he should remain in the juvenile system.
Do you think that Mr. Tyler T. has a statutory right to have the department make a recommendation?
No. I don't think there's anything in the statute that requires a recommendation.
So is there something that requires that the department report? Could the judge just say, I'm not going to ask the department here?
The judge under the statute may have an agency prepare a report.
Or may not.
Correct.
Counsel, if the Chief Justice was done. Mm-hmm. Counsel, what is the rule that you are asking to have emerge from this proceeding?
What I'd like to see emerge from this proceeding, obviously what I'm critically interested in is Tyler, and I think the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed, the juvenile court decision to waive should be reversed, and we should go back and have a new waiver hearing with a new waiver investigation.
I understand the very specific thing you're asking.
But on a larger scale,
yes.
I want to be sure I get that in. On a larger scale, I think the rule that would work in this case would be for this court to prohibit ex parte advocacy with the department staffing meeting at this point in the waiver process, prior to the report being prepared. Now, I think what the court should also do in this opinion is clarify that the department functions as an agent of the court, and it's the department's function to be independent and neutral and present an unbiased report as an arm of the court. And I think if the court has this rule that there should not be ex parte advocacy at the staffing meeting and clarifies the role is consistent with the juvenile code, that this is an agent of the court and it needs to be independent and neutral.
So in other words,
gets out.
Sure. So in other words, had defense counsel been invited, and I suppose, would the issuance of the invitation be enough, or would there have to be actual presence?
I think we're talking about notice here. I mean, on a practical level, I can't imagine, frankly, a defense attorney who wouldn't.
I agree with you. However, I think the issue is implicated or could be implicated in the future.
Yeah, I think that when I say ex parte advocacy, I mean advocacy by one party on his own.
Now, you draw the analogy, and you do it quite thoroughly, to the pre-sentence investigation reports in the criminal realm, but there are some important distinctions to be made. and your opposing counsel has done so in the brief. They include the fact that the author of the report from the Social Services Department, unlike the author of the pre-sentence investigation, is subject to cross-examination at the waiver hearing. And second, the juvenile may present evidence on his or her own behalf at the waiver hearing. How did those distinctions play a role in your consideration of the analogy and the rule you're asking us to adopt and the basis for that rule?
Well, I think the analogy still holds strong. I think that those distinctions, when you look at a sentencing hearing and a waiver hearing, certainly at a sentencing hearing, the defendant can present evidence and testimony. So we have really similar proceedings when you step back and look at them, and that's why I think the analogy holds.
But the one that's closer to the point here would have to do with the cross-examination. Outside of correcting certain errors and presenting, there could be in the judge's broad discretion, there could be some error correcting permitted at the sentencing in regard to the PSI, but it seems to me to be a lot broader in terms of the questioning the author of the social services study would be subject to.
See, and I don't know that it is a lot broader. To me, I think they're very similar. I don't know, that would defense counsel be precluded in an adult sentencing of calling that person as a witness?
One is for error correcting. The PSI is to correct the errors, but here it's a far more open field, it seems.
I don't see the distinction as being that clear. I think that we have a blurring here of what's going on at these hearings. And when you look at, for example, what needs to be presented in a pre-sentence report and what information is presented in a waiver investigation report, the overlap is tremendous.
There is great similarity.
And the same thing in terms of where does the pre-sentence come from? Well, it comes from the court having generally a probation or parole agent prepare this neutral report for the court's benefit, just as the waiver investigation report has the court designating the agency to prepare this neutral report for the court's decision. The hearings, I think, do look very similar in that generally the rules of evidence don't apply in either one. The criteria that the court's going to be considering in imposing a sentence and deciding on waiver is very similar, too. The character of the offender, protection of the public, seriousness of the offense, those all overlap in both the sentencing.
Counsel, did I hear you correctly that you don't quarrel with the idea that the writer or the people who are going to make the recommendation can contact defense counsel or the DA and have communications, phone conversations, talk to them in the hallway? You don't have any problem with that, right?
That's correct.
It's just the DA actually attending this meeting.
It's the advocacy component that I really have a problem with. I think there's information and there's advocacy. And when you have ex parte advocacy, particularly, I mean, the facts in my case are that the DA was at this meeting.
If the DA weren't there and they just placed a phone call to the DA and not the defense lawyer, would your argument be the same?
I still have a problem with that, yes.
Okay. Is there any reason to believe that defense counsel's and the defense's position wasn't adequately presented at that staffing?
I don't know what happened at the staffing meeting because we have no record of it. So I know there's a split. There's information in the record that there were strong feelings both ways, but if I was defense counsel at that level, I would certainly feel like I can't be certain that anybody there advocated the way I wanted to advocate. I also think that we have to remember there would be a difference between the people attending that staffing meeting and an attorney. I mean, as I was starting to say earlier, we have a prosecutor who's trained to be an advocate. It is his job to advocate and persuade a jury or a judge. That's very different from having members of the department discuss a case.
But, yeah, a waiver hearing's a little different animal than other kinds of hearings just because, you know, it has to occur early on. The DA has to want. If the DA didn't want to initiate this, I mean, the court could ask that a waiver investigation occur, right?
Yes.
I mean, so the court technically could initiate this, not the DA.
Although if the court did initiate it, then a different judge would have to preside.
I'm just trying to figure out, let's just say both lawyers were there, but only questions were asked of the DA. What do you think then?
Well, then
they have to answer those criteria, and some of them are pretty protection of the public or the public's best interest. The DA essentially represents the public,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
So that is an inquiry that has to be answered. If they need the DA to answer those questions in order to prepare a proper report for the court, is it wrong to have the DA answer those questions? Or are you saying you got to pick up the phone and ask the DA? You can't ask them in person in the staffing meeting.
To me, the difference isn't the telephone or the in-person. It's the ex parte advocacy. That's the difference here. So if you're calling the DA to say, I can't reach the juvenile's aunt, do you have a number for her? And the DA says, sure, here's the information I have on that. That's information, not advocacy.
What if you're calling the DA to say, hey, you represent the public here. Do you think it's in the public's best interest for this juvenile to be waived to adult court?
Then the DA's response to that, to me, is advocacy, because the DA is advocating for his position as the person who filed the waiver petition.
But that's part of what they have to report on. That's their statutory requirement to have that question answered for the court. Is it in the best interest of the public?
Sure.
Are they supposed to just make it up? I mean, the defense lawyer doesn't recommend what's in the public's best interest. They wouldn't go to the defense lawyer for that information.
Sure, but I don't. If you don't have the district attorney's input, I disagree that then you can't answer that question. I think that's a question that can be answered without a lawyer's advocacy telling you what the answer should be. I think the social workers are gathering up all the information about the juvenile's personality, what's available in the system, and I think they can make a determination on what they recommend. Ultimately, it's up to the court in the end, but they can make a recommendation on the protection of the public.
Can the DA be forced to file an adult criminal complaint against the juvenile?
Forced by whom?
Anyone.
No, it would be the DA's decision whether to file a criminal complaint.
Right. So if the department wanted to know, hey, if we recommend waiver, are you going to proceed? Do you think that's a legitimate inquiry?
Well, if they recommend waiver, it doesn't mean that he's going to be able to proceed because we have the next step of the court.
Right. I understand that. But in the end, don't you think it'd be important for them to know what the DA thinks about the case? Because otherwise, why even go through this whole thing if you have a prosecutor who won't prosecute it?
It seems to me that if the DA has filed the petition for waiver, it's pretty clear that he wants waiver. If he's filed the petition in the petition for waiver, he has to justify
why
he
thinks. But it doesn't always occur that way necessarily. The court could recommend.
The court could recommend. So if you're talking about a hypothetical where the court recommends, the DA doesn't, and the department is saying, well, this is an unusual circumstance, we don't have you recommending it, what do you think? I don't see the problem with having defense counsel part of that conversation as well, just as a balance. I don't see that as a difficult burden to say ex parte advocacy is something we should avoid.
I hear you, and what you're saying has some appeal because it's practical. I mean, why not include both sides to this? But is it statutorily required is really, I think, our call here. Is it something that is required? Is it practical? Would it be a good idea? Would it hurt anything? Probably not. But is it required really is our question we have to answer.
Based on the juvenile code and the way the juvenile code is structured and the way, again, as I said at the beginning, we have a defense, we have a prosecution, and we have the court, that yes, the juvenile code, the way the department is set up as an agency of the court, that it's improper for there to be ex parte advocacy under the code. Now, I'm not going to be able to cite you a provision, but I'm saying the code as a whole makes it clear how these three entities are structured and that would prohibit ex parte advocacy.
Thanks.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant District Attorney Wiedenfeld. You have 30 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Zeke Wiedenfeld. I'm an assistant district attorney in Walworth County, and I appear on behalf of the state with the authorization and supervision of the Attorney General's office. The issue before the court today is whether the prosecutor's appearance at a Department of Human Services waiver recommendation meeting is an improper ex parte communication with the court that requires a new waiver investigation report as well as a new waiver hearing in front of a different judge. This court should find that the state's appearance at the waiver recommendation meeting was proper because the juvenile code encourages the exchange of information and does not prohibit the state's appearance at these meetings. Also because the waiver report did not make any recommendation on waiver, and even if it had, the judge is required to make his or her own independent decision regarding waiver.
Counsel, what about the idea that if the defense lawyer were there, maybe they would have made a recommendation and it would have been a recommendation against waiver?
Even if there had been a recommendation against waiver, the court's required to make its own independent decision regarding waiver. And when the statute regarding the waiver report actually indicates that the court can rely on the facts in that waiver report, but doesn't say anything about relying on the recommendation of the department. So I don't believe that the court's bound by that recommendation, and I don't believe the court is permitted to be influenced by the recommendation of the department.
Counsel, I don't know how you draw the line as a circuit court judge, always, but sitting, if you sat as a circuit court judge and you had a department saying we don't want, you know, the DA has filed waiver, and the department says we recommend against waiver. You know that there has been this, and I'll use the term spree of robberies by this fellow. And in Illinois, they didn't put him in the adult system. In Kenosha, they didn't put him in the adult system. Now, that doesn't mean that I wouldn't put him in the adult system, but I would have at least in the back of my mind that all of this is going on pretty close in time. No one else is waiving him. The argument advanced by the department is not to waive him, and that might affect my decision as a circuit court judge.
It might affect the court's decision, but it shouldn't. The court should be making an independent determination about whether or not waiver is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And as you point out, in this case, the state of Illinois as well as Kenosha mm-hmm. County had contested, Kenosha had a contested waiver hearing, and the issue of what was going to happen with the juvenile in Illinois was also disputed. So I think in this case it was clear that it was a disputed. It wasn't an easy decision for anyone.
Is it your position that the judge cannot consider the recommendation of social services with regard to waiver? That's what I heard you say. And I know the statute speaks of not considering the recommendation of the state and not considering the recommendation of the juvenile's attorney, that you can't be swayed by that. You have to do it independently. But I don't think it addresses or suggests that the court can't consider the recommendation of Department of Health and Social Services.
I agree that the statute doesn't address this situation. The statute doesn't say that the departments are required to make recommendations. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that the court's required to rely on them.
No.
If they do make recommendations.
Is it your position the court cannot? I heard you in response to my question, counsel, indicate that it would be wrong for the judge to consider the Department of Social Services recommendation. I just want to refine that. Is that what you're really saying?
I guess maybe it's a subtle distinction, but I think that the court can consider it, but the decision to waive can't be based on that recommendation.
Does 2M even call for the agency to make a recommendation?
It does not address the issue of making a recommendation. What it says is that it should provide a report analyzing those criteria, so it doesn't say anything about making a recommendation.
Do most of them make recommendations? You've probably seen more than I have in the department recommendations.
It's not part of the record, and I can't speak to what other counties do, but in Walworth County, yes, there typically is a recommendation made along with that report.
And I understand that really is part of the record to the extent that the social worker testified that this was unusual not to make a recommendation. Yes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Wiedenfeld, did you have a chance to look at other jurisdictions to see if there's been similar cases decided by Supreme Courts or Courts of Appeals in other jurisdictions?
I did not. I have not researched other states regarding their waiver procedure and types of hearings like this. I know that I did start to research Illinois because this case did involve Illinois as well. They have a very different system from Wisconsin, and I didn't consider it comparable from my initial research into it, so I didn't even get into it.
Now, suppose this was not the decision-making meeting, which is what I understand it was. And let's suppose that it's not merely a telephone call asking what the aunt's telephone number is, but there's a conversation about Tyler T. with the prosecutor. May range, are there any other convictions, any other arrests in any other state or in Wisconsin, or any number of questions about facts, and might even say to the prosecutor, have you talked to him? What's your impression that this guy's going to be a continual repeater? Which is an advocacy question, and say, you know, you think he's really dangerous? It was. And so it becomes advocacy, and then 2 days later, whoever's doing the investigation speaks to defense counsel and asks questions. What's the uncle's number? And similar kinds of questions and comments that are made to, that had been made to the prosecutor. I don't have any problem with any of that. I think you get your information from whomever. You're smart enough if you investigate to know that it's an advocacy position that they have, that they're going to take in court. You put it in for whatever it's worth, and you make your own recommendation. And I would be loath as a court to have a hard line, thou department shall never talk to either side, defense counsel or prosecutor, alone. You always have to do it together, or it can only be straight facts and keep a record of it. I think that's too much. But here we are, if I understand the facts, at a final meeting to make a final decision to give to the judge. And there you allow one side to advocate. Doesn't that bother you? Do you think that's the best practice if you had to do it over again?
I really think the best practice is to allow the department to conduct their investigation however they feel is appropriate.
Anything goes.
I think however they feel is appropriate. In this case, they felt it was appropriate to gather information from the prosecutor at that meeting. In the next case, they might say it's appropriate to have both of them there. But I don't believe that the court should regulate how the department conducts its investigation. And there are benefits to meeting with attorneys independently of each other, and that's that you cut down on that adversarial nature of that, I don't know if you want to call it interview or discussion. So there are benefits to meeting independently.
But here, the defense counsel didn't get that opportunity.
Here, the defense counsel was given that opportunity. She did speak with the intake worker at the courthouse on different occasions. She also had the full opportunity at the waiver hearing to cross-examine the worker who had prepared that report.
Defense counsel did not have full opportunity at the meeting.
Defense counsel was not given.
Everybody was there. Defense counsel never had that opportunity, did he? Was she?
She was not invited to the meeting. I agree.
Well, she didn't have that opportunity.
To attend the meeting, correct. However, I do believe she was given the full opportunity to present her position both to the department as well as to the court at the waiver hearing. The department worker, Mr. Thompson, did indicate that if the attorney had called him and said, I'd like to meet with you and discuss this case, they would have been more than willing to meet with the defense attorney.
My recollection of Dr. Thompson's testimony, who's the deputy director, as I understand it, was that he characterized your presence as at that meeting as advocating a position, indicating others also advocated positions one way or the other, but didn't suggest that it was merely just providing information. Would you say that my understanding is incorrect?
I don't recall exactly the words that Dr. Thompson used, but I agree that it was characterized as advocating. I really don't see, as I believe the Chief Justice pointed out, how you can separate the two. Really all advocacy is providing facts in a persuasive manner. So if somebody is asking questions and you're supposed to respond with the facts of the situation, I don't think there's any way that it wouldn't come across as advocacy. The department shouldn't have been surprised that that was the state's position at this meeting, as the state had filed the waiver petition. So when they invited the prosecutor to the meeting, it's not that they didn't know at that point that the prosecutor at least thought waiver was appropriate. So there was that expectation there.
Maybe it was you that, rather than Dr. Thompson, the question you asked Dr. Thompson was, and so it's not just that I was there arguing that there should be waiver and nobody else wanted to do so. There was some sort of compromise reached, and Thompson says, no, there was fairly strong feelings for waiver prior to your presence. So I think that's what I was referring to, counsel. Let me ask, let's say you don't prevail. And then I'll ask if you do prevail, to be balanced enough. But if you don't prevail, what happens with this case?
I guess, are you asking under the hypothetical that this goes back, the court does order a new waiver hearing and a new waiver investigation report?
Mm-hmm. I'm asking you, what happens?
Okay. Well, I guess if the court rules that my presence at that meeting was improper, the court could still find that there was no harm because the juvenile was given the full opportunity to litigate this at the waiver hearing. If the court still felt that, as a matter of law, any communication with the department was inappropriate and ordered a new waiver hearing, this would then go back before the circuit court for a waiver hearing in front of a different judge, if that's what the court...
Are there any problems with timing or age that would be an impediment to that?
The juvenile has turned 18. However, he still would be entitled to a waiver hearing on that issue. I believe that at that new waiver hearing, the circuit court could consider his age at the time of that hearing. So it would come up that he would no longer be eligible to be placed on supervision. He'd no longer be eligible for the Serious Juvenile Offender Program or the other programs available to people who have not yet turned 18.
In other words, if he went back to juvenile court and he was not waived into adult, there are limited... What can the court do to him? What can the juvenile court do to him?
The court could adjudicate him delinquent.
Right.
And
okay.
I'm not aware of any other supervision.
Couldn't put him under custody in any institution.
I don't believe that secure detention facilities would accept him now that he's turned 18.
Can't put him under supervision of parole, probation, extended supervision. Nothing.
No.
He walks.
Not that I'm aware of.
Does the court retain jurisdiction of the case, however? I was under the impression that jurisdiction can extend well beyond 18.
The jurisdiction can go beyond the age of 18, but I believe the order that would go beyond the age of 18 has to be entered before the juvenile turns 18. So there's the potential... In this case, there isn't the potential to retain jurisdiction, but in most cases which are resolved prior to the juvenile turning 18, there is that option.
Oh, that seems like quite a challenge, doesn't it? I mean, if you would not prevail, I'll be asking this of your opposing counsel. Then what?
If
your argument, that's in the back of my mind, your argument in large part
depends on distinguishing the PSI from the waiver hearing. I mean, I hear you doing two things. Distinguishing the PSI from the waiver hearing is one part of your argument, and then also arguing free flow of information is another essential part of your argument. I don't want to mischaracterize, but that's what I understand it to be. Certainly there are distinctions between a waiver hearing and a waiver report and a PSI report. But there are lots of similarities also. And we have cases that talk about the similarities. In fact, sometimes the state shows up and argues about the similarities because they advocate for the similarities because it advances their position. Sometimes, like here, you're showing up and arguing about the differences because that advocates or advances your position. So there are differences, but what difference do those differences make here? There are distinctions, but are they distinctions without any significant difference?
I guess there are distinctions between the waiver report and the pre-sentence investigation, and I don't believe that the law should be the same for either one. However, even if this court were to say, we're going to apply the pre-sentence investigation law, we think they're exactly the same, I don't believe that the juvenile would prevail even under that law regarding pre-sentence investigations.
Why not?
The cases cited by the juvenile under pre-sentence investigation law, there's really three main ones. The first one is Souchacki. That was a situation where the pre-sentence investigation writer was married to the prosecutor.
Right.
And as a matter of law, the court found that there was bias in that. Here there's no such relationship present between myself and anyone at the Department of Human Services.
So that's a distinguishing case.
Correct. And what's also interesting about the Souchacki decision is the court did say that there was bias, but found that the due process rights of the defendant were not violated at that sentencing hearing. There wasn't a new sentencing hearing that was required in that case because the court was made aware of that relationship and the parties were aware of it as well and were allowed to address that at the sentencing hearing. Another case cited by the juvenile is State versus Howland. That was a case where the state was found to have violated a plea agreement because the state called up the PSI writer after receiving the report, complained about the recommendation in that report. There was then a change in that recommendation after those discussions with the prosecutor. The court in that case held that it was a violation of the plea agreement. Here there's no agreement between the state and the juvenile not to advocate at the waiver hearing. Also, what's interesting about Howland is it did briefly address the issue of ex parte communication. And what it found is even under those facts of the Howland case, that there wasn't ex parte communication. It said that it bordered on ex parte communication and cautioned about it, but there was never a finding that it actually constituted ex parte communication. And I think the facts of that case are far more serious than they were here. Here, the report hadn't been prepared yet. The state was just invited to participate in this meeting.
Counsel, although those are factual differences, some of the language, both in Howland and the Souchacki case, your opposing counsel advances should be the same. For instance, this kind of language is found in both. I'm quoting from the Souchacki case. The integrity of the sentencing process demands that the report be accurate, reliable, and above all objective. Because of the requirement that the report be objective, it is of vital importance that the author of the report be neutral and independent from either the prosecution or defense. That's at the page 518. Do you think that applies to a waiver report? That language, is that applicable, even though the facts are different?
I believe that the department should try to be objective in preparing the report. However, due to the differences in the systems, I don't think it's possible for them to be neutral. In my brief, I sort of lay out the roles that the Department of Human Services take on in a juvenile case, which is very early on. They make decisions whether or not a juvenile can be held in custody. They make a recommendation regarding whether or not charges should be filed, or they're able to enter into a deferred prosecution agreement. So those roles early on, which are prosecutorial-like, I think prevent them from being completely neutral. But I do think it's appropriate for them to try to be objective. And in this case, Worker Bradley testified that she did try to be very objective when preparing the facts in the waiver investigation report.
Let me, and that same language, identical language, appears also in the Howland case. That is, the court said there, it is of vital importance that the author of the report, there the PSI, be neutral and independent from either the prosecution or the defense. That's paragraph 36 at Howland. You would say that premise does not apply in a waiver. Is that your argument?
I think that they should try to be, but I think it's impossible for them to be considered neutral. And I think it is possible for them to be neutral and independent of the prosecution and the defense, but not from the process, because they're involved in the process. Unlike a PSI writer who receives the case just prior to sentencing, knows that there's been a conviction and knows that they're supposed to prepare a report, but hasn't been involved in charging decisions and things.
So just to fine-tune that, what I hear you saying is you agree they should be neutral and independent from either the prosecution or the defense, but because of their experience, they're not neutral from the process. Do I have that right, or am I not capturing it?
I think you have it correct. I don't want to misstate my position, because I'm not saying that neutral and independent means that they can't communicate with either side. I really just think it means that they need to try to separate themselves when they prepare the report.
That's your position, in effect, what you've just stated, that you can be objective, neutral, and independent. That is, the department can be, even though the department invites only the prosecutor to its final decision conference and allows only the prosecutor to speak.
Yes, I think that they can be
position.
I think that they can be neutral and independent.
Those are good objectives. You should hold them to it. But that in this case, the fact that they invited the prosecutor and let him or her advocate, and not the defense counsel, does not make them non-objective, not neutral, and not independent.
Correct. I think that, like I said, they knew coming into the meeting what my position was, but they still have information to gather from both meeting with the prosecutor and speaking with the defense counsel as well.
Well, it seems, counsel, in addition to the two arguments concerning the analogy to the PSI process as well as the fluid nature of the exchange of information in juvenile matters, you lead off in your brief, and I think you started discussing a line of argument which Justice Ziegler had been asking your opposing counsel about, which is the plain language of the statute. And if we turn to Section 938.08, subsection 1, we see that the intake worker appointed to furnish services to the court, quote, shall make any investigation, which apparently was done here. Yes?
Yes.
And exercise any discretionary powers that the court may direct, which I don't know if the record reflects that there were any discretionary powers granted to the author of the report, but presumably we would have heard about it if there had been some improper exercise.
Correct.
And keep a written report of the investigation. The investigation was written in this case.
That's correct.
And submit a report to the court. And that was done here.
Correct.
And then you read that in tandem with the In Re DH case, which you've cited at page 20 of your brief, which it also seems to me is one of the main prongs of your argument here, that in this case, the juvenile court, a juvenile court may inform itself regarding facts and circumstances bearing on waiver, quote, in any manner it deems suitably reliable, subject, end quote, subject to the juvenile's rights to notice and to contest or supplement the information, something that apparently was done here.
Correct.
Reflected, I was struck in preparing for this matter by the initial comments of the circuit court judge when presented with the objection from Tyler's attorney, And it seems to me his comments were something along the lines of, gee, I think it might be a better practice to also invite the defense counsel, but all of the procedures were followed pursuant to the statute.
Correct, and I believe that the judge did also state that it was satisfied with the hearing and the information that had been presented. The judge said that he understood that he had that option of ordering a new report prepared, but he didn't think it was necessary because of all the information that had been presented at that hearing. And I really think that the hearing on waiver is the place where the juvenile's rights are protected. He has the opportunity to call the person who drafted the report to the stand to take testimony, to elicit any sort of bias that he thinks has been present in that report or in that investigation or in the recommendation, and can also call witnesses. Here, the juvenile chose to testify himself as well as call other witnesses to testify on his behalf. So he was able to present all arguments that he felt were necessary.
Could the defense counsel have called you to ask what you told the staff?
I think the court would have discretion about whether or not it felt that was necessary, but yes, I think that they could. If that happened, then there would have to be a new prosecutor assigned to the case. I guess the caution I would give is you don't want to open the doors to any time a juvenile doesn't like the prosecutor to then call them to testify at the waiver hearing. So I think there would have to be...
This is a special one where you were present. I don't know if they could have called people that did the staff report, and I don't know whether they could have called everybody in the room, and I don't know if therefore you would be in the room and would be subject to that kind of same questioning.
There's no limit on who the juvenile can call to testify at the hearing. I think the limit would be discretionary by the court, mm-hmm. saying now we're getting repetitive where we've already had testimony mm-hmm. on this issue. Mm-hmm.
There are any other questions?
Just following through with what the Chief Justice was asking you, in weighing whether or not to allow you to be called as a witness, wouldn't the judge be looking at factors such as whether or not that would then require replacement of you as counsel, and that obviously you had been picked to be the person to represent the state in this matter? Isn't that one of the factors that cases talk about?
I believe the court can consider that. I think the court can also consider are there other means of getting that same information in here. The other people at the meeting could also be called to testify.
That's my recollection of the case law as well.
And that's really part of my point, that allowing somebody outside the department to sit in that final decision-making opens the door to a lot of other things. And that, therefore, since it would open the door to the possibility of a new prosecutor having been appointed, shouldn't allow the prosecutor to be there in the first place.
The prosecutor, I believe, is appropriate. It is appropriate for the prosecutor to attend that meeting. When we went through that analogy, I acknowledged that they could call me as a witness. I also think I could request to call the defense attorney as a witness since they provided information to the intake worker. Mm-hmm. I think that same analysis would then mm-hmm. be applied. Mm-hmm. I don't think that
there's... And then you have the problem of counsel being witness, and at that time, does counsel have to be replaced? You don't always have to do that, but that's also a matter of discretion.
Correct.
Well, would that be a matter that could be left up to the sound discretion of the trial court? If, as opposing counsel points out in her request for us to articulate a rule or to articulate an observation, that this committee serves as an organ or an agency relationship to the circuit court, and then in light of DH, where the circuit court can collect information in any manner it deems reliable, couldn't the circuit court order a parameter in regard to these reports and the production of these reports by saying, I want you to gather the information, but I don't want the prosecutor there unless the defense counsel is also invited?
I don't think the statute's unclear on what the court can specifically order regarding a waiver investigation report. And I guess I would just caution about finding that the court or the Department of Human Services is acting as an agent of the court. The statutes allow the court to take on some of those roles of the Department of Human Services, but when the court does accept those roles or take on those roles, it's then required to get off the case. That's laid out in 938.10, where if the court decides to enter into a deferred prosecution agreement make other discretionary decisions that the department is given, that then a new judge is required. So I think there is a distinction that doesn't necessarily mean that the Department of Human Services is acting as an agent of the court. But I do believe that they're preparing the report at the direction of the court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Alicia?
I'd like to first address Justice Bradley's question because I think that's very important, and I have a different take on it than the state did.
The question was that, Kevin.
The question was what options would be available
right.
if we were to prevail in this case, if Tyler was to prevail and we go back and have a new waiver hearing. I disagree with the state that there aren't options for disposition. We all agree that there's jurisdiction, that the juvenile court would still have jurisdiction. And when you look at the statute where that comes from, which is 938.12(2), it specifically says the juvenile court retains jurisdiction even if the juvenile is now more than 17 years old. So looking only at that statute, I would say, why is that provision there if then the juvenile court has no tools to address disposition? So that's one point. The second point is I have scoured through these statutes to find the answer to this question because it occurred to me as well. And I did not see anything in the statute that said, in the code, that says once you're 18, there's nothing we can do with you. There's quite a bit about extending orders past the age of 18 or 17. There's a lot in terms of extension and change of placement. But when you talk about, is there something in the statute that says once you are 18, we cannot do X, Y, or Z? I didn't find anything. And I think the real answer probably comes from the fact when you look at the waiver criteria in 938.18(5), one of them is what services are there available in the juvenile system? Is the juvenile system equipped to handle this? What can the juvenile system provide to this individual? So it seems to me we go back and have a waiver hearing. The department prepares a new report. They're required to address that particular point, and then that's discussed at the hearing. But I don't want to say that there are no options because I don't think there's case law that says that, and I didn't find that in the statute. So that may be a question that you all are presented with down the road, perhaps, but I did not find anything that says once you're 18, we can't treat you.
But you agree with the prosecutor that what the juvenile court can do as a sanction is a factor that the court would consider in waiver?
Yes, it's one of the waiver criteria, definitely. The next point that I think is important is we're talking a lot about, you know, was this impartial? The report's supposed to be neutral and independent. And to me, what's really important is the appearance of impartiality is almost as important as the impartiality itself. And we have an appearance of impartiality in this case. And as I said way at the beginning of this argument, I don't know who it affected, how it affected them, whether it affected them. Those people may not know. But what I do know is there's an appearance here because we have a prosecutor at this departmental staffing meeting where they're making the decision, and he's advocating, and it's ex parte.
How does that position relate to the holding in In Re DH, though, where it says that the circuit court, then the juvenile court, a judge may gather the information in any way he or she deems to be reliable?
Well, again, I mean, I think we come back to we don't know the impact this information has on the juvenile court judge, and he may not know that. So no matter how we look at it, we're left with the appearance of impartiality. because of the role that the prosecutor played in this. I mean, I think it's illustrated by the questions that were just posed to the state, which was, well, we could always call the defense counsel to say what she said, or we could call the prosecutor, but then that attorney might have to be replaced. And we just get down the slippery slope of, was this impartial? What really happened? Who did it affect? What went on at that meeting? Is that what we want from our waiver hearing? Is that what the court wants out of a waiver hearing? Or do we want the facts presented without any appearance of impartiality? And then the court can make the decision it's supposed to make instead of going down this road. So I think that we need to remember the importance of the appearance of impartiality.
But the trial court, according to DH, it seems to me, serves as the gatekeeper and serves as the line of first determination as to whether that's met. And here, apparently, it survived. The objection was timely made and timely addressed by the circuit court. And so it seems to me the court made a determination. Is that determination entitled to deference?
I would say that determination actually is not entitled to deference for the reasons set out in the PSI cases, which is the juvenile court can say, I wasn't influenced by this. This is the information. The juvenile court didn't say, I wanted this to happen. I mean, the juvenile court said, I don't think this is right, but the juvenile court doesn't know.
I don't think he quite phrased it like that.
You're correct. I'm not quoting from the record. But the implication was that he would be more comfortable had this not happened, but he felt he could set it aside. But when you look at those PSI cases, the concern they raise is, can you set it aside? And what those PSI cases say is, maybe not. Maybe you can't set that aside. So the juvenile court can say, I'm not influenced by that, so I think this is okay, but we don't really know, and he doesn't really know. And the way to avoid that is to not have this happen in the first place. And to go back to the rule that you asked me about, and I think, Justice Ziegler, I appreciate saying that it was a practical rule because that's what I was trying to accomplish, which is let's not have ex parte participation, ex parte advocacy at these departmental staff meetings. If that doesn't happen, we avoid these mini trials. We avoid anyone having to make a determination that this didn't influence me. We avoid the appearance of impartiality, but we still allow this free flow of information. So I think what happened in this case is on the extreme end, and because of that, we should have a new waiver hearing with a new waiver investigation report.
Thank you, Ms. Alicia. I want to thank you, Ms. Alicia, and you, Mr. Weidenfeld, for your presentations today. Of a juvenile case. We don't have too many of them before this court. A waiver has been an issue that has come before us, and the PSI, so it's quite a combination and a very important case. And that ends our hearing in 10 AP 784, State versus Tyler D. The court will take a few moments in recess so that the Hamilton High School students may leave if they wish. And I see a group of Hamilton High School students coming in now. Same number. Is that a different group?